Hi, Patrick Cox here in the World Newsroom in Boston, and this is The World in Words, number 44. Today's podcast, most of it, has a Japanese theme. We hear about writer Haruki Murakami's fan base. Yes, fan base. Also, a conversation with a kanji holic. And did you know that in 700 years' time, many words we use now will be mere fossils? But which ones? A supercomputer has the answer. That and a favorite foreign phrase from Vampire Weekend's Ezra Koenig.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
It's embarrassing when Europeans come over here. They all speak English, and then we go over to Europe, and all we can say is, merci beaucoup.
Yerkshamash. Thank you, Borat. And what did you do on your week off? The World is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. The Big Show is broadcast on more than 250 public radio stations around the United States. Listen online at theworld.org. That's also where you can check out all of our other podcasts. We've been multiplying of late. We now have a podcast on just about everything, on science, the global economy, history, technology, world music, and much more. A podcast for every taste. Well, almost. We don't as yet have a podcast on wrestling. Sorry, Borat. So, most of today's edition is Japanese-related. We have a report on the worldwide fans of Japan's best-known writer, Haruki Murakami. We also have an extended conversation with Eve Kushner, whose book Crazy for Kanji has just come out. Kanji are the most revered of Japanese characters, the ones with the best stories to tell. And we eat sideways with a member of the Vampire Weekend. But first, as they love to say on the radio, but first, the future of words, common words, words that we use every day. Well, guess what? Some of them may soon disappear. Well, not that soon. According to a new study, we might actually be able to figure out which words are going to vanish by taking a look at the history of words that are in use now. Here are the Big Show's Lisa Mullins and first, Alex Galifant.
So, Lisa, these are five words that I'm just going to read to you, and I want to see if you can draw any conclusion from the words. I.
Yes.
Who.
Me.
To.
Oh, sorry.
Three and five.
I, who, two, three, five.
Yeah, that's it.
Three of them are numbers.
Let me put you out of your misery.
I'm sorry to disappoint you.
But the words are extraordinarily old.
They're old. Okay,
like 10,000 years or more old.
And you know this how?
From the brain of a supercomputer, which has been analyzing words back through time, looking at not the concepts, but the words used to describe concepts. And it's picked out those words that if you were to go back 10,000 years from now and were to say the word three or the word I, the sound would be sufficiently similar to the word used back then that you would be understood.
That we're using in any language now.
Indo-European languages.
Uh-huh.
That's what we're talking about.
Okay.
And here's the lead researcher, a guy called Mark Pagel, who's a professor of evolutionary biology at the University of Reading in the UK.
Language changes very rapidly compared to the rate at which our genes evolve. But I think what we think is remarkable about these things, these results we've come up with, is that some elements of language are changing so slowly that they are comparable to the rate of change of genes.
Okay, so they've figured this out using algorithms and models, et cetera. Did they come across other words, Alex, that we might expect would be extremely old? Horse or food or water, something that would have been relevant 10,000 years ago.
Right. Take the word horse or the concept of a hill or the concept of bread. You think that these words would just be unchanged because the concepts, the objects would be unchanged. But that's not necessarily the case. Here again is Mark Pagel at the University of Reading.
Many of those words we would expect would have what we call a half-life. That is, there's about a 50% chance that they would change in a given amount of time. Their half-life, we would reckon, would be around 2,000 years for most of those words, maybe less, maybe even 1,000 to 1,500.
And the chances of a word, say in English, disappearing goes up if there are more words out there in the pot for us to choose from. So say the concept of something being dirty. There are, it seems, 46 different words amongst the Indo-European languages to describe the concept of dirty. So there are lots of options for the English language to pick and choose from as things, you know, mix up and melt together and all the rest of it.
Okay, so the more competition like that, the more chance the word itself is going to die out?
Exactly. And get ready to lose the verbs to stab, to squeeze, to turn, to wipe.
Wait, we
to
do.
Push.
We turn and wipe and stab and squeeze all the time.
You should enjoy them because they could be gone. You know, in 700 years or so at least.
And we will miss them. Thank you, Alex Galifianakis.
Thanks, Lisa.
Okay, who am I to argue with a supercomputer? But I have to say that if there's one thing we can learn from the history of word usage, it is that predictions, and prescriptions for that matter, they seldom play out the way they think they will. Certain overlooked words suddenly become popular, while other popular words just as suddenly lose their appeal. So take that, you supercomputer. Now, Japanese. If you didn't catch our previous podcast on Japanese, check it out. It's number 34. There's a report on how the desire to read manga and watch anime in the original Japanese has created a new generation of Japanese learners here in America and beyond. There's also an interview with manga translator and general entertainer An Ishii, and a peek inside the vault of the manga grandmaster, Osamu Tezuka. This time around, we're going to play some word games with a kanji addict. Kanji are the best loved of Japanese written characters. They're hated too sometimes by those who have to learn them. Before that, we're going to spend some time in the presence of some fans. And in this case, it's worth bearing in mind that the word fan is short for fanatic, because Japanese writer Haruki Murakami attracts a certain fanatical devotion. Murakami has just turned 60. He's one of the most widely read novelists in the world. Books like Norwegian Wood and The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle have sold millions of copies. They've been translated into nearly 40 languages. Here in the U.S., Murakami's rare public appearances are greeted with reverence. Here's a story I did for The Big Show last November on Murakami's fans. If you go to the exquisitely designed website, harukimurakami.com, you'll hear this soundtrack. At first, it sounds creepy, then otherworldly. But the longer you listen to it, as you're trolling through the site, learning about what Murakami eats, drinks, and listens to while he's writing, as you're doing this, the music becomes mesmerizing and finally comforting. Not unlike Murakami's writing. His favorite lunch, by the way, is eel. This month, Haruki Murakami visited the U.S. He spoke in front of two audiences in New York and Berkeley, California. His only public appearances here this year. No cameras, no tape recorders, just a whole load of devotees. The Berkeley appearance is sold out, 2,000 people. People who feel deeply affected by Murakami's stories of vanishing women, confused men, and talking frogs.
When you try and explain, what the story is about to somebody else, they just give you the look like you're absolutely crazy. Like, how in the world does this make sense and this captivate your attention so much?
It's a very intimate setting where you feel like he's talking to you. You know his thoughts intimately.
The way that he looks at relationships, it's so real. I just love his books.
Some people are so spellbound by his writing that they try and fail to track him down in Japan.
Dear Mr. Murakami, I'm writing you this letter because I'm a documentary filmmaker and currently in Tokyo shooting a film about you and your books. I would very much like to talk to you about the strange magical world you always manage to create, the world of Murakami.
The world of Murakami is not typically Japanese. His prose isn't flashy, but it is littered with English words, sometimes even English grammar. That makes his books difficult for older people in Japan to read. Not that that makes him any less popular, says Roland Keltz, who interviewed Murakami several times for his book, Japan America.
Haruki's fan base in Japan skews young. They tend to be teens or 20-something. And they are almost desperate to connect with him.
And Murakami connects right back. Every time he has a new book out, he starts up a website and chats with his readers. He'll answer most questions about his musical tastes, his writing habits, his wife. Other questions, too. One Japanese fan asked whether she should have told her dying aunt that she had terminal cancer. Murakami answered that if he were dying, he would want to know. Roland Keltz says Murakami feels protective of his readers.
He thinks young people in Japan are very, very lonely, and they find in his novels some feeling of warmth or stability. And so he tries, as he says, I try to help them.
Murakami writes about loneliness a lot. His own literary heroes are Kafka and Dostoevsky. But Murakami's lonely world is warmer. He often shows affection for his protagonist, less Kafka than J.D. Salinger. Murakami translated Catcher in the Rye into Japanese. Now, as his fan base outside Japan grows, so does the obsession with Murakami the person. For American fan Eve Kushner, it's the fact that he's so normal.
I feel he's writing all the time about the most mundane activities possible. And I find that kind of comforting to think that this superstar in the literary world is spending so much time thinking about boiling spaghetti and which jazz record to play, that kind of thing. And so he's kind of one of us, and that makes me want to know him so much more than if he really had that celebrity, unattainable sort of feeling to him.
So Kushner reads everything Murakami writes and everything written about him. She knows that his best-selling novel, Norwegian Wood, is finally being made into a movie, and that Murakami has just finished writing a new novel.
You know, this blind love I feel for him and the way I feel pretty sure I might throw myself at his feet if I were to encounter him. I suppose I should be embarrassed about it.
But she's not. Haruki Murakami has taken her and millions of others on a wild chase around his imagination. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox. Now, the last Murakami fam you heard in that report, Eve Kushner, well, she's a woman of many passions. Among those passions is deciphering kanji. Kanji is a particular group of characters used in Japanese script. The cool thing about kanji, aside from the way they look, is that when you combine them, you get these great new meanings. I know, all characters and letters do that, but the kanji combinations are, well, a lot of things. Delightful, intriguing, baffling, mind-blowing. Eve Kushner maintains a blog on kanji. I'll post links to that at the Facebook group The World in Words, as well as at patrickcox.wordpress.com. She's also just published a book called Crazy for Kanji, which is exactly what Eve Kushner is. I began by asking her what kanji is and where it came from.
The Japanese language, to write full sentences, they interweave three scripts. They need all three. They all fulfill a function. Kanji is one of the three, and it is by far the most complicated looking. The characters came from China originally, and then they faced an enormous task of matching their spoken language to these characters, because the characters came with pronunciations from the Chinese language, but Chinese sounds very different from Japanese, so it created a mess, and that mess has translated through into the experience we have today of reading it, because many, many characters come with two pronunciations, which are radically different from each other. So one, for instance, the character for new, the old Japanese way of talking about new is atarashi, and the Chinese way, or rather the Japanese modification to the old Chinese way, is shin. You might have heard of the Shinkansen, it's the bullet train. That first part of it, shin, meaning new. So you have to know both.
Well, let's look at some examples, and maybe I can steer you towards some of the simpler ones, just because I think that would be would be helpful for me.
Sure.
So here we have a couple here that you've introduced in an early blog post that you did.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just talk us through a couple of these?
Sure. Okay. Well, the word for esophagus is shokudo. And by the way, shokudo is a homonym that means many things. But in this case, it means esophagus if you use the characters that the first, it's two characters, and the first means food or to eat, and the second means the way. The second one is the road. So this do, you hear it in Aikido, Judo, the way of those things. But in this case, it's the way of food. The esophagus is the food road. And I think that's the most charming concept I could think of. You know, esophagus, such an ugly sounding word. It doesn't conjure up anything, but the food road. You get it in every level, you know, what that word is doing, what the body part is doing. It makes sense of the world for you. And for instance, I have an example of glacier and iceberg. An iceberg, if, you know, people who are reasonably good in English, we know that means ice plus mountain, which is true. And actually, it breaks down in exactly the same way in Japanese. But glacier, we might think, that sounds like ice. Don't know what the I-E-R is doing exactly. But their word for glacier breaks down as ice plus river. And at first, if you don't know anything about a glacier, that might sound like I think they got that wrong. It's not a frozen river exactly. But seeing that prompted me to research glaciers, and I found out that they spread out along valleys in a river-like way. And so you've got this whole, you know, concept of the world embedded in this tiny word, almost like a haiku, this incredible compression of information. And it's beautiful. It's this explosive amount of information. I mean, it can explode for you if you engage with it. Otherwise, you could look at it and say, yeah, that sentence is about a glacier, and you move on. I guess those are your choices.
Yeah, that's right. It's that compression and also the combination of things that create either another thing or an idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, just pick out another one then. Oh, yeah, like in a trance, dream plus middle, two ideas that then create a further idea that advances those two initial ideas.
Absolutely. And it's as if you're in the middle of the dream. I can't think of a better way to express it. I like moment, one plus to blink. So a moment is the time it takes you to blink. Can't really quantify it in any other way. And any way that we might, you know, in terms of, I don't know, nanoseconds, that leaves you kind of dry. But
that's great.
Yeah. This one, goat is mountain plus sheep. And I don't know what to think of it. I think it's charming. In terms of accuracy, I'm not so sure, as I'm kind of convinced that they're different species, whether they're on a mountain or not.
And up in Alaska, they have mountain sheep, right?
Okay, there you go. So sometimes it seems a little bit, almost like a child made that one.
Yeah.
And so there's an innocence, maybe, in the worldview.
This was another one that I really loved, a little bit more complicated, and it took a while for me, without understanding any of the Japanese implications there, to actually get my head around. But once I did, it was just fantastic. This is what, four characters, one meaning before, the second meaning tiger, the third meaning after, and the fourth meaning wolf, meaning one calamity falling closely on the heels of another. If you think about that, before tiger, after wolf, and you're in the middle of that. It's great.
Yeah, I can't think of two worse calamities than being chased by a tiger and being eaten by a wolf. That's fantastic. It's poetic. It's descriptive. It's vivid.
So when did you first start studying
kanji?
Kanji.
Okay, well, I started studying Japanese in 2001, and then my third class was in fall 2002, and then we were introduced to kanji. And I have to say that because the introduction was so poor, both by the textbook and the teacher, I became frustrated and confused, and I was full of questions because nobody sat down and oriented me properly. So I took it upon myself to get the knowledge I wasn't getting in class. And part of that was I got a book called Kanji Pictographics, which allows you to pick apart each character as if every part has meaning, and to see how things are combining. So this is the sun, and that's woman, and if you put a sun with a woman and a fire, you get, you know, something. I think I just made that up. But so that's how it started, and then the more deeply I got into it, at some point, I don't know how, resentment turned into love and fascination and obsession, and there are 50,000 kanji used in Japan, but really they say you only need to know 2,000 to read a newspaper. That might not sound like a lot, but it's enormous when they, you know, when they look as complicated as they do, when so many of them look alike, and when there's so much to study just about one character. So, for instance, right now with my kanji blog, I'm writing about one of the simplest-looking characters. It's got, I think, 8 strokes, not much. And it means taste or flavor, and that's how people see it most of the time. And so they don't think twice about it. It's got two ways of being pronounced, aji or mi. But actually, I discovered so much material that to write about it for 6 weeks wasn't enough. And that's kind of blows your mind, one character. So if you applied that kind of depth of investigation to 2,000 characters, you'd be at it 24/7 and still not making much progress. And so for me, that's part of the fascination, too. It's kind of, I was talking to somebody yesterday about Yosemite and El Capitan and how it feels to stand at the bottom and be awed by that. And I feel that way at the base of redwood trees, and you feel how small you are. And for the strangest, most perverse reason, that's really gratifying, to feel small in the face of nature or in the face of the infinite. And I suppose some people might think of that with religion, but for me, you know, kanji is my religion. So I actually relish the thought that I could study this forever and not really get very far. And for other people, I'm sure that's incredibly discouraging. But it shouldn't be if the journey all along is so fascinating and gratifying.
Right. I mean, you note that you spent a staggering, in your words, amount of time on this every day. This is not the same as studying even another non-Western script language. This is something quite different.
Right. You know, one thing I love about these characters is all the history that they've accumulated in many ways. And one is that the shape changed because they didn't have typewriters or word processors, so people were copying them and they made mistakes. And then on top of it, there are all these regional variations. So things happen in different regions with different rulers, different dialects. You know, all these things happen. The Japanese language has changed, just like the English language has changed. So we don't really understand Chaucer. It seems, you know, like a different language. Same thing with Old Japanese. Sometimes when I'm studying kanji, it feels almost like looking at the Grand Canyon, you know, the different striations, the layers, and you're seeing history in that way. And it's beautiful, you know. You don't have that many opportunities to see human history or geological history in front of you, displayed, in a beautiful display at that.
Do the Japanese share this obsession with their own characters, or does it take an outsider to actually sort of see the beauty in them?
It's a great question, and it's a complicated one, because to some degree, a lot of people resent it, because they go to cram school. They have it crammed down their throat. They spend so much time actually learning the characters that it bars them from learning history, chemistry, but they have to learn all that too. So they're going to school twice as long as we are. They have a whole separate set of friends at cram school. So, of course, there's some resentment, and they cannot possibly stop and experience this the same way I do. And in fact, on top of that, then a lot of them have, and mostly I'm talking here about the younger generation, people in their 20s and 30s, they have a sense of personal deficiency when it comes to it, inadequacy, because the more they use word processors and texting and all that, the worse they're getting at kanji, and they feel it slipping away. They know it's happening. So it's just another level of, man, I went through all that. I need to know this. I don't even know it anymore.
Eve Kushner, it's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it. It was my pleasure.
To Niger, Morocco, Uganda, Angola, Zimbabwe, Djibouti, Botswana, Mozambique, Zambia, Swaziland, Gambia, Guinea, Nigeria, Ghana, Rwanda.
Ever wonder how many nations there are in the world? So you won't have to memorize any long lists or sing in public to try your hand at the GeoQuiz, the daily quiz that's heard on PRI's The World, is now a podcast, and you can download it for free at theworld.org.
Okay, now it's time for Eating Sideways, where we pick a word or a phrase that's hard to translate into English, but translate it we do. Last week, we strayed somewhat from this template and ran a phrase in Indonesian that was simply untranslated, at least for English speakers. The tape was of U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton appearing on a TV show in Indonesia. The show's hosts asked her to say this in Indonesian.
Salam hangat.
Salam hangat.
Terdahsyat.
Terdahsyat.
Untuk.
Untuk.
Keluarga Indonesia.
Keluarga Indonesia.
Yeah.
I appealed for a translation, and lo and behold, I got one. In fact, I got two. One from University of Rochester linguistics professor Scott Powell, and please excuse the pronunciation, Himawan Prajogo, who lives in Indonesia. They both gave me the same English version, give or take a preposition. Here it is. Warm and awesome greetings to the Indonesian family. The word awesome, in this case, seems to be a play on the name of the TV show, which Hillary was appearing on. TV show is also called Awesome. And the reference to the Indonesian family means the Indonesian people. So, don't worry, Hillary, your words in Indonesian were diplomatically sound. So far, Madam Secretary of State, so good. Now, for this week's phrase, Kwaza Kwaza. On the big show, we interviewed Ezra Koenig, guitarist with the New York-based Vampire Weekend. And he had this to say about the Kwaza Kwaza.
The Kwaza Kwaza is a dance that kind of originated in Central Africa, but became popular all over Africa. And one of the things that I like about it is that it's spelled K-W-A-S-S-A, kind of looking like maybe it is actually like a Swahili word or something. But really, that's just another way of spelling Kwaza, meaning like what's that in French. So, you know, already there's this kind of interesting mix of cultures in the word alone, a byproduct of French colonialism. So there's a lot going on, even in that phrase.
And if you want to do the Kwasa Kwasa as you're listening to this podcast, well, this should help. Aimer, mon sango. Aime-moi avec le cœur. Car j'ai mis le mien de ton côté. That's it for this week. You can find me on Facebook, at the group page, The World in Words, or you can email me. That address is language@pri.org. More foreign wordy stuff next time. Mama razi si kamote maini anaka mape kisaka te bakabola kapena makasi teme onga bolima silikobeta leka ya sele.